Okay, for the next 3 hours, we are going to go behind the very special secret door. Just who's behind there, one only knows. So we'll be back with our first one in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, well, so let's open up our first door. Well, there it is. Kind of hokey, but somebody's back there. Hello there. Who are you?
Howdy, George. This is your old friend Jim Mars.
Hey, Jim.
Speaking to you from the wilds of rural North Texas.
Well, welcome to the secret door, which is an occasional concept here where somebody shows up and I have no idea who it will be. And you're the chosen one, I guess, for the next half hour. How are you?
I'm doing lovely. And hearing the creaking door reminded me of the old radio days where it was usually the shadow.
It does. We're bringing back old-time radio, Jim.
The shadow knows.
Now, to some of you new listeners, Jim Mars is an award-winning journalist. He has had more than 30 years' experience with several Texas newspapers. Several years ago, he began teaching a course on UFOs, and you correct me if I'm wrong here, Jim, perhaps one of the first on the university level to teach UFOs. And you've investigated the U.S. Army's remote viewing program 3 years before it was publicly acknowledged by the CIA. You produced, of course, The Alien Agenda, Rule by Secrecy, and you're one of the best, my friend, and a regular on Coast to Coast, so I'm glad you're able to walk in here.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be able to step through your creaking door.
What have you been working on since we last chatted months ago?
That's a deep, dark secret. I'm working on a new book that, if it doesn't get suppressed like a few others of mine, is going to be a real blockbuster. I can't really talk about it at this time. I'm still in the research and writing end of the thing. But as the year progresses, maybe later in the fall, we'll be able to share some incredible information with you.
Let's talk about some updates recently, of course. UFO cases, Jim, all over the place. I can't remember a time period where we've had so many good cases bunched together.
Absolutely. It certainly seems to me, and it may be wishful thinking because, I've been thinking for 40 or 50 years that maybe they're going to go ahead and start telling us stuff. But I have to agree with you, George. I think that we see an incredible crack appearing in the embargo on public discourse regarding the reality of UFOs and extraterrestrial life. For instance, we had the French government has released their UFO files. If you remember a couple of years ago, I think it was the Mexican defense minister released gun camera film from their Air Force of UFOs. We've had all of a sudden renewed interest in the CD program. We've had Dr. Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project. And I think the thing that really caught my attention here was just a few weeks ago when the former governor of Arizona, Fife Symington, went on CNN, of all places, and revealed that he had actually seen this thing that overflew Phoenix back in 1997. And that despite his disclaimers at the time, he saw it. He said it was amazing. It was huge. And I think his description was it was an alien spaceship.
Well, he believed that. We had him on the show, Jim, a couple weeks ago.
Right.
And, he has changed his tune. But you know what he told us? You know, he was involved in a pretty bad personal situation then. And he figured, you know what? I'm not going to magnify the personal problems I've having and come out and say, I saw a UFO too. So he made light of it and it bit him. And, he came forward now 10 years later, apologized for it. And I think that's pretty gallant of him to do that.
Yeah, I agree. And I would hope that other government insiders might take the cue and start coming forward and say, okay, here's what's going on. Here's what I know. Here's what I experienced. We can only hope.
The day will come, I think, when we will find out what we've all been seeking for. I love it when you have, like, the French government beginning to release reports, Brazil beginning to release reports. just a matter of time, isn't it?
That's true. In fact, according to my sources, I don't know how good they are, but they claim that apparently because of a lot of things that are going on, the war in Iraq, Afghanistan, the unrest in the world, the acquisition of nuclear weapons by small, aggressive third world countries, the economies, I think that the decision may have been made at the very high and secret levels that maybe it is time to start coming forward. I would have to point to the former Canadian Defense Minister, Paul Hoyer, who has said, and I agree with him, that perhaps the solution to our global warming problem could be found in the use of ET technology.
That could be. Let's move a little bit into something else that has really affected all of us, and that is really the quest for the truth, the quest to find out what is going on, what happened during that horrible day in 2001 on September 11. You have reviewed and have done a lot of extensive work into some of those cases as well. Do you remember the Popular Mechanics article that came out a few years ago, basically trying to refute what some of the conspiracy theorists were reporting? You remember that one?
Oh, I most certainly do. And what I found of the most important thing of that whole report was that their chief researcher, the person providing all the information, was a Benjamin Chertoff. And when he was contacted and asked if he was any relation to the then Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff, he said, "Oh, gee, I don't know." But when an enterprising reporter called his mother, she unhesitantly said, "Oh, yeah, he's our cousin." So you have to kind of wonder. And, of course, prior to that special edition on debunking the 9/11 myth, there had been a whole shakeup at the company that runs Popular Mechanics, and a lot of people had been given their walking papers, and they had a whole bunch of new people in there. It'd be interesting to know what their particular philosophical and political leanings might have been. But as you can see, and as you well know, you could go back to 2002, and I remember we talked, and I was yelling, screaming, trying to tell people that there's too many questions, too many unanswered ambiguities and controversies about 9/11, and we really need to find out the truth of what happened there. And I was kind of like a voice crying in the wilderness, and now it seems like it's almost socially acceptable to question it, as well it should be, because some of the more overriding questions have never been answered.
What took some people, Jim, so long to get on the bandwagon? I mean, just, you know, Rosie O'Donnell now is beginning to question it. And, you know, we're not talking about the merits of whether people are right or wrong, but what took them so long?
Well, I think that there is a very natural inclination to, you want to love your country, you want to trust your government, you want to be a good citizen. And I think that for a while, we were all basically traumatized by the events of that day. And while in that fluid state of mind, I don't think anybody wanted to consider that there might be other aspects to that that might even point in very strange directions. For example, as a newsman for all my life, you know, I've been taught, conditioned, and have been experienced in just following the evidence. And when you begin to follow the evidence, it has a strange way of turning back towards the administration and the federal government. For example, everyone recalls that just a few days after 9/11, there were mainstream media reports that there had been some very suspicious short selling of stock in
yes.
American and United Airlines and
some insurance companies. Yeah.
Yeah, and their insurance carriers. And they all put that out there, and then they said the FBI is going to investigate this because this gives evidence of foreknowledge, and we're going to see if this doesn't track back to Osama bin Laden, the culprit du jour. And but then you never heard any more about it. It just kind of dropped off the radar screen. And the problem is that when you start following that evidence of foreknowledge, it tracks back to people who are connected to our Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, and I tell you what is also a little disturbing, even though we get little glimpses of the search for Osama bin Laden, I really don't hear much going on. We either have a very quiet group of special forces trying to get him, or we basically have given up, and I don't know which it is. I mean, they keep saying he's between the Afghan-Pakistan border back there in the foothills. I don't know what's going on there. I mean, part of me, Jim, says they don't even want to find him.
Well, if you just listen to what President George W. Bush said, and this was back, I believe, in the late spring of 2002, when everything was still pretty fresh, and at a press conference, some reporter asked him about Osama bin Laden, and I'm paraphrasing, but almost word for word, he said, well, we haven't heard anything from him for a while, and frankly, I'm not that concerned about him anymore. What? Wait a minute. I thought this was the guy who was behind the worst terrorist attack on America ever, and our president's not concerned about him anymore?
Did you ever, over the last few months, pick up any more information about the JFK assassination? You've done some work on that, and, you know, I still don't think that's going to go away, Jim.
No, of course not. I think the most recent thing is the death of E. Howard Hunt, who, of course, maintained that he had nothing to do with it. He was home with his family at the time of the assassination. But then his protestations of innocence actually led to a slander suit against a publication that had named him as being in Dealey Plaza. And when that got to a civil court jury, they ruled against Hunt. And now we have his son coming public saying that on his deathbed, he admitted that he had been approached by people within the federal government to assassinate Kennedy. And but then he still couched it by saying, oh, but I'm glad I didn't go for that. So it was kind of a limited hangout. He acknowledged that there was an internal plot, but then he still tried to distance himself. But by the way, his family, or particularly his son, and some information I got from one of his daughters said that they always wondered why he was not home on the day of the Kennedy assassination.
Weird. You know what's so amazing is here we are, and I thought about this when Fidel Castro was ill and they thought he was going to die, and now he's resurrected. This guy has outlived them all.
Yeah.
You know? And he has witnessed everything. What an incredible story that is.
Oh, yeah. And there's going to be some real turmoil when he passes from the scene, because I think there'll be other things that come out. And I think there's going to be a power play there in Cuba, you know, to try to see who's going to take over. It's going to be real interesting to see how that shakes out.
There's no question that when Fidel Castro dies, I think the big play is going to occur again.
What's kind of sad is that some years ago I was actually down at the headquarters of Alpha 66 in Miami, and the old guys, of course, the original people who fled Fidel, been over here for years, and now their sons, their grandsons, and these guys, George, are still going out into remote training areas, shooting guns and testing weapons. And I think they really truly believe that when Castro dies that they're going to be able to run down and mount another Bay of Pigs invasion. And but personally, I just don't see that happening.
Well, something will happen, though, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
be an attempt.
Yeah, I think so, too. They're not going to let Castro's brother merely just run with it.
No. And I'm not even sure that the Cubans are going to just sit by and let that take place.
So this new work that you're working on, you can't give us a little hint?
Well, let's just say, okay, all right, let's talk about this. A small portion of it involves the...
Because you know you're going to break it when it's out on this program anyway.
That's true. And I can tell you this, that one small portion of it has to do with the growing body of evidence, especially since the collapse of the Cold War, and now there's people are beginning to get access to German documents from World War II, and it's becoming very, very evident that they not only had drawings and schematics of flying saucers on the drawing board, but it seems most likely, and based on all the evidence now available, that they were actually testing prototypes and flying UFOs around.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I can't wait for this one. When will your work be complete?
Well, it'll probably be next year before it actually gets published. But there's going to be some things in there that's going to really shake people's cages, and we're going to have to kind of reevaluate everything we think we know about World War II. Of course, for the most part, and I've been a kind of a lay aficionado of World War II for many, many years, and have read all this stuff, and for some time was even a member of the military book club, wanting to get everything that was coming out. But if you stop and think about it, George, you'll realize that everything that we read and studied, everything through the 50s, 60s, 70s, was about the battles, okay, and the generals, yeah. Rommel the Desert Fox. And another thing that has always captivated my attention was the Eastern Front, the war from with Germany against Russia. Because, of course, with the Cold War, you couldn't get any information out of there. The Russians were always proclaiming that they had actually won the war, and we thought that was just communist propaganda.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things going on. But, for example, in the summer of 1943, you had the Battle of Kursk. This was a big bulge in the front lines that ran all the way from Leningrad down south to Stalingrad and deep in almost into the Caucasus Mountains. And the plan was the Germans were going to pincher it off and try to destroy several Russian armies. And, of course, they didn't make it. That was one of the most stupid battles I've ever heard of because they kept postponing their battle. And in doing so, the Russians, of course, realized exactly what they were up to and built these huge defense systems 12 lines deep on either side where they knew the attack would come. And the Germans knew that they knew. And yet they went ahead with it anyway. And they did make some progress, but they were never able to close off the pincher. But the point here is that the Battle of Kursk, the German military, the Wehrmacht, lost about three-fourths of their mechanized force, which is incredible. In fact, from that point on the Eastern Front, it was only a slow holding action, trying to hold off the Russians as they slowly but exorbitantly pushed on into Germany. So, you know, maybe the Russians weren't exactly lying when they said that they were helped win the war. And especially when you couple that with the fact that when the Allies, 26 Allied nations, launched D-Day, the invasion of France at Normandy, which is further down than they thought the Germans would expect it, they typical military strategy, they were trying to use the strongest of their force against the weakest of the German defense. And yet we all know how touch-and-go D-Day was. We just barely made it. And we were only facing one-fourth of the German military. Three-fourths of the German military was on the Eastern Front.
Exactly right. Well,
so there's a lot of amazing things that we don't really know and are just now finding out. I recall in the 50s and 60s, the big controversy about World War II was who was the Soviet spy on the German general staff, and they were naming everybody up to and including Deputy Fuhrer Martin Bormann as being a Soviet agent. And then when Colonel Winterbottom in Britain published his book, The Ultra Secret, all of a sudden the world finds out about the Enigma machine, which all the young people now just know about that. It's been centered in the center of TV shows and movies and everything else. You know, we got their decoding machine. We were reading their mail. We knew what the Germans were going to do, sometimes before their own field commanders knew what the plan was.
Hey, Jim, we look forward to that book, and more importantly, thanks for coming in behind the secret door.
Well, I'll just creep out through the secret door right now, and it's a pleasure to have been with you, George. I'll make my own creaking noise.
That's Jim Mars. behind the creaking door. All right, next up, who's going to be behind the secret door? We'll find out on Coast to Coast AM. Would you like to pick up two free shows? Art Bell interviews with the late Father Malachi Martin on exorcisms. Well, you get that when you subscribe to the After Dark newsletter. You can go online at coasttocoastam.com or you can call 1-888-727-5505. When we come back, who's behind the secret door? Okay, now let's go behind the secret door and see who might be back there. Hello there. Who the heck is that?
The Shadow Knows.
I still don't know who this is.
I decided to beam back.
Now I know. George. Richard Hoagland. I am so glad. I am so glad it's you because of what you sent me, I guess, late yesterday.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. How come this is not being bantered about?
Because NASA's hiding things, as usual.
Richard, I got to tell you, it's a great image.
Well,
I
wait till you see the really cool stuff. That's only a browser version.
Well, why don't you tell us what we're talking about?
Okay. We've been talking on this show for months and months and months now, ever since March of last year, a year literally, about this incredible spacecraft called Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is a spacecraft loaded for bear. It's got literally a world-class telescope on board, over a 20-inch size telescope, aimed looking down at Mars from an orbit that takes it as close as 180 miles. And it's been taking superb pictures of all kinds of regions. And you and I have discussed the idea that we had to get this audience in campaign mode. And if NASA didn't do it on their own, we had to basically create the context for Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to take pictures of Cydonia, in particular, the most interesting and celebrated artifact on Mars, i.e. the face on Mars. Well, last night, as you're doing your show, suddenly, with no fanfare, no announcement, no warning, no nothing, across my electronic desk comes the first MRO high-res image of the face on Mars, with details as small as a few inches visible in the 300 megabyte high-res version. And I have spent the last 24 hours, literally 24 hours, actually more like 26, looking at this thing, trying to figure out where do I begin. So what we have done tonight is we have put up on the Enterprise website a direct link at the top of the EnterpriseMission.com page to the high-rise MRO website in Arizona, at the University of Arizona. This is the official high-rise camera site.
Right.
Everybody can go to Enterprise, click on the box at the top, download this image. If you're lucky enough to have a computer that can handle 300 megabytes, good luck. If you're not, there's a browser size image there, which is like 2,000 or 3,000 lines, you know, vertical and horizontal. And just take a look at what I sent George in the browser version. And then tomorrow during the day, I'm producing a paper which will have some very high resolution close-ups of specific regions on this structure. And I'm telling you folks, before you go to the computer tomorrow, you're going to want to get extra socks because I'm going to knock your socks off of what you're going to see.
And I've got to tell you, Richard, you know, I've been looking at this image two ways. The one way that came in on the attachment you sent me,
yep.
And then I turned it around, and I got to tell you, it looks like another face, but a different kind.
Yes.
It's weird.
Yes. Kinsia, who's our art director, official art director of the Enterprise mission, and I have been discussing, since I think 2001, we did a piece together where we assessed the artistic background of the face on Mars. In other words, if you assume the idea that this is an artifact left by a genuine ET civilization, and you know, George, what my prejudice now is, that it's us.
Yes.
It's our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers.
We are who they are.
We are who they are. And if you look at this thing in that context, and we'll get into some ancillary information in a minute, while that model really tonight has won. Boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, you know, dogs and cats, we have won. The fighting is over. This is unquestionably an artifact. And I'm going to demonstrate that in the remaining 20 minutes I have before George opens his secret door for the next guest. But if this is a work of art, George, then it's been our idea for some time that it was a work of art designed, as all works of art, to communicate something and maybe more than one thing simultaneously. I mean, the best art works on many different levels. So back in 2001, when Dr. Michael Malin, who was in charge of the camera on the previous Mars mission, Mars Global Surveyor, took this, you know, full-face image, what we finally got him to take in the spring of 2001, we saw that if you flipped it upside down, you could actually see what looked to be, and this is going to sound so corny coming from me, the image of a gray, the image of the classic, almost cliched alien. I hear you laughing, George. And
well, because you may be right.
Again, in the model that we're looking at real science and we're pursuing real evidence and real clues, if the current mythology, if the current discussions that you have with, you know, people like Jim, you know, a few minutes ago, or with people that you had last night, is real, and this is part of our phenomenology, this is part of our environment, these things are actually going on. People are being kidnapped out of their beds and out of their cars by somebody for purposes unknown, and they're all reporting the same kind of figure. Isn't it remarkable that completely separately, when you look at this work of art on Mars, it, if you turn it upside down, it appears to embody another version of that iconic image that was made so famous initially, actually, by Whitley Strieber's work back in the 80s. And as you said last night before that, this seems to be the folks that Betty and Barney Hill, who I had the privilege of actually spending a whole evening with and interviewing way back in the 60s, the mid-60s, 1965, that they also saw in the wilds of New Hampshire coming back from that vacation on that very lonely New Hampshire road. So there's the beginning of a potential convergence here between the area of expertise that I've been looking at, which is archaeology on another world, and the standard phenomenology of the so-called UFO community and what they have been trying to grapple with varying degrees of success for the last, well, what, 60 years since Roswell?
Tell me, by the way, you taped Betty and Barney, and we can do a whole show on that.
If I did, the tape is vanished into history.
I know it. You see,
You have a tape you've been looking and looking and looking for.
I can't find it. That was with the psychiatrist, Dr. Simon.
Doesn't that drive you nuts?
Yes.
When that happens?
See, you know, in your life, you move from place to place.
Oh, yeah.
But I had a special box for some broadcast mementos that I've always done. For example, do you remember when Richard Nixon opened up the doors to China when we sent the table tennis team there? Do you remember that?
Yes,
it was,
of course.
It was the table tennis that opened up the door to China.
Yep.
And I called the head guy of the tennis group. He was out of the Detroit area, I believe. His name was Graham Stevenson. I'll always remember that. I got a hold of him while he was in Beijing, and I interviewed him. And at that time, the Mutual Broadcasting Network, that's going way back, they aired my little series of reports that 21-year-old George Norrie put together. And I mean, I love it. So I had this box, Richard, and in that box was the Dr. Simon interview about Betty and Barney Hill. I can't find any of it. I can't find any of it. And it was a small box. By the way, wasn't there an earthquake near Mexico today, somewhere
in Mexico? There was a 6.2 earlier this evening, and I understand parts of Acapulco and Mexico City are without power, and we have no word on casualties yet. I'm kind of monitoring that while we're having our conversation here.
Okay. All right. Very good. You might want to update us through the night on that if it gets really bad.
Okay.
Acapulco, of course, being a huge tourist area, that was some rumbling. Well, are they going to take pictures of what you've always called the city and the pyramids?
Well, we're hoping this is only the beginning of a series of photographs because, frankly, when I look at this picture, this huge 300-megabyte picture of the face and just the immediate surroundings, there is stunning, stunning stuff. I mean, when I stood at the United Nations and at NASA many years ago and had actual official invited briefings by NASA of us, of their teams, of their scientists at the Goddard Space Flight Center and at the NASA Lewis Research Center – I projected what we're seeing in this image tonight. Incidentally, if people want to actually get copies of those briefings, they are on the Enterprise Mission website. If you go to that box at the top, the MRO box of this new image, there's a line under that box which is a direct link to the DVD series that we have produced based on our UN and our NASA briefings, which is a good background for what you're going to see in the next few days, because frankly, George, we have tonight architecture on the face on Mars. We have absolute ruins. If I were to, and I'm going to try to do this, I'm going to do a side-by-side comparison between ancient ruins in the Middle East, which has a climate minus, you know, the atmosphere and the water vapor, which you don't have on Mars, very similar to the Martian deserts with drifting sands and dust and all that. And if you let stuff go in the Middle East and it falls into ruins and then you have dust storms and sandstorms, it looks incredibly like the stuff we're now seeing in ultra close-up on the face on Mars. I have said for years that the face on Mars was not a Mount Rushmore. It was not a carved stone face looking up into space. Everyone else has said, oh, it's like Mount Rushmore, except bigger. No, I have said consistently in the Monuments of Mars, which is my seminal work on this investigation going back now 25 years, that the face on Mars was a huge, huge building. It was an incredibly complex artificial structure that would give us absolute, you know, we'd be able to see the girders, I've said, if we had high enough resolution. Well, tonight I can announce that I am looking up at the screen right now at some of the high-res enhancements we have done from this incredible image taken by MRO, and I am seeing, George, the girders. And tomorrow and in the next couple of days, as we continue to do these close-ups and I do the comparisons, we'll put them on the Enterprise website, and everybody can compare their results when they download the raw data from NASA. It's actually not raw, but it's basically what the official version is, and they can then compare that, and they'll see this detail is visible even in the NASA version, except we're improving the signal to noise, and we're changing contrast a bit so you can see it better, because the image that's on the web is huge, and it's not really prepped to see what it is in terms of all the detail that there is there to see.
Richard, fantastic. You know, as I've said all along, your theories continue to get proven correct, even though people have scoffed and sometimes have ridiculed you for some of your far out, I used to say outlandish theories. But, I mean, you know what? And so we come down now to one of the big ones. You know, I'm not talking about hyperdimensional, though I do want to talk with you about that at a later time, because I just got Edward Lead Skaldnin's book called Magnetic Current.
Yep.
And I'm just starting to read it, and it'll probably take me a day to read it because it's not very big. But I want to talk with you on another program about that, because I think his secret is in that book. But I need someone like you to decipher it for me.
Okay.
But I got to tell you, I mean, we are honing in now on Cydonia, which I think could tell us the secret of the entire solar system, maybe the universe. And if you've been right on every other theory, even though people have laughed at you, you know, there's water on Mars. Everyone's laughed at Richard. There's water on Mars. And all the way down, this one could be right, too. You've got an amazing hit rate. Why should we assume now that you're wrong?
Well, the evidence is in the pictures. You know, take a look at the pictures, take a look at the archaeological comparisons, and then you make your own decision. And what I decided to do tonight, mostly because of practicalities, I mean, again, you know, this opportunity is sneaking up on you behind the secret door and laying this
on you,
given that it's just 24 hours old, was too good to resist. So I didn't have the time to prep the kind of stuff that we normally do. So we're going to let people look at the official data first, see if they can find these cool, amazing things on their own. Because remember, the face is about a mile wide and about a mile long. So that's about 1 square mile, right?
Yep.
There's a lot of real estate in 1 square mile. There's a tremendous number of these ruins. Remember, this thing has been beaten to death by the sands and the winds and the time of Mars.
And it looks like maybe also water.
It
doesn't it?
Well, that's
there's some
problematic
slopes.
We don't know that. That's an interesting, you know, if we had more time, and we will at some point, we can get into some of the ways that this civilization could have died and why water may have been a part of how they died. But by and large, I think we're looking at wind erosion. We're looking at abrasion. We're looking at sandblasting. And you can see areas where you can see walls and fragments of walls sticking up and casting these long, spiky shadows across the rest of the face. And, you know, you can see windows. You can see the girders, folks. You can actually see the girders. Now, remember 7 months ago I was asked to do a thing for the National Geographic?
Yeah, I remember that.
Yep. Well, we hoped that we would have an MRO image of the face to talk about, but NASA was not so obliging. So what I did as preparation, I sent them the high-res MRO version looking down from orbit of the Spirit rover. And the Spirit rover has a stovepipe antenna sticking up about 3 feet, and it's about 3 inches in diameter. And I sent to one of the producers a close-up from MRO of the Spirit rover, taken looking down from 180 miles up, and I showed him how you could see in the shadow, because it was late afternoon sun, like this photograph was taken late afternoon sun. The sun is about 17 degrees above the western horizon when this picture was taken. And I showed him how you could actually see this little tiny 3-inch wide antenna shadow stretching out across the sands of Mars as Spirit was perched on the edge of Victoria Crater. And I said, in anticipation, if we can see that shadow, we should be able to see the girders of the artifacts if and when MRO takes a picture of, like, let's say, the face. Well, tonight, we've got that image. It's 300 megabytes. That's a big image. And just drool over it. Just spend time. Just look and look and look. And the more you look, the more your eyes will get used to looking. Because most of us are not raised to be looking down vertically on a set of ruins in a very, very dry desert. So it takes a little bit of kind of acclimation. You have to get used to how that perspective works. I remember back when Robin and I first got together, we'd spend hours and hours at the computer, and I would show her these aerial views of ruins. And, you know, I would educate her eyes so that she could then look at the Mars stuff and see similarities in some of the lower resolution data that Surveyor and the Athena spacecraft were taking. But now we've got these incredible images which have literally a few inches resolution. The actual discriminating size of an object you can see is less than a yard in these images.
I know, it is incredible.
You can see walls, you can see, as I said, these... I mean, this stuff looks like the Anasazi ruins here in the southwest if you fly over it and look down from an airplane.
It sure does. Now, and when you say we are they, are you saying they physically came here or... You know, maybe the organisms of Mars came here during the explosion.
That's part of what I call the soap opera.
Yeah.
And the problem with soap operas, if you ever follow soap operas, is they have 15 different plot twists. We don't have data. We don't really have ground truth data, George, to figure out that part of the soap opera.
Okay. So we don't know.
We have clues. We have lines of evidence. And I'm going to be speculating about some of that now that we've got this under our belt. I mean, this is a stunning new development tonight. This is a breakthrough equivalent, George, to quote Jim again, to finding out who really did Kennedy again and why. It's of that magnitude, because now tonight I can talk to any critic and I can absolutely challenge them. You show me why these aren't ruins. They're geometric. They're half buried. They have spars. They have girders. They have fallen walls. They have all the things that you would say was instant archaeology if you found it on Earth. And the only thing that makes it different, as I said at the UN at NASA years and years and years ago, and that's what you can see on these tapes, I said the only thing that makes this not archaeology yet is because it's in a place where no one has expected archaeology, i.e., the planet Mars.
I do have Richard's phone number, his toll-free number for his DVD series. Those of you who don't have computers, that's 877. That's toll-free, by the way. 1-877-345-6222. Very easy to remember. 877-345-6222. And he's got this incredible picture link up there on the coast on his enterprisemission.com website. Rich, thanks for coming through the secret door, Richard.
I will tiptoe out and have a good evening, George.
Tell me who the next guest is. Is he there?
He's waiting in the wing. We're giving the secret handshake right now.
We'll be back. By the way, 20% of the power out in Acapulco because of that 6+ earthquake.